This is Lesson 3 of Medicine and Morals. The topic this week, as I'm going to put up right here on the PowerPoint, is, as you can see, it's called Rolling the Dice, Risky and Experimental Treatments in Jewish Law. What does Jewish law have to say about risky and experimental treatments? In the first lesson, we talked about a little girl who was 13. She needed a heart transplant in order to live. The heart transplant was more than likely going to work. We explained there's an obligation according to, in Jewish law, to preserve life, which means that if one is facing certainty of death, God forbid, if somebody is facing certain death and they have an option that will cure them, most of the time they are obligated by Torah to pursue that cure. Torah doesn't say you're allowed to. You're obligated to preserve life. If behind you is death and in front of you is an option that's 51% likely to work, you have to pursue it. Okay. What happens if the odds are not in your favor? What happens if, God forbid, a person is facing certain death, but the payoff or the cure is not coming in at 51% or higher, it's coming in at 50% or lower? In other words, there's either a 50-50 chance that it's going to work, or maybe even a less than 50% chance that it's going to work. In other words, risky treatment. Let's give an example. Let's put a case to this scenario. Irena, will you please read this? Page 86. Case study 1, Tom.
Tom is 15 years old, a heavy drinker, and a smoker. He's told that he has serious heart disease that will lead to his death in the near future. A quadruple bypass, together with a dramatic change in lifestyle, will alleviate his illness and allow him many more years of life. Tom is aware that all such surgeries are risky, but his case is complex. Tom's underlying health issues mean that the chances of success are not great. His doctors sensitively inform him that his chances for surviving the surgery are not higher than the chances for failure. Tom wants surgery. He wants a chance at living long enough to see his grandchildren grow up. His wife, however, prefers he let nature take its course. Her sister went in for surgery for heart problems just last year and died on the operating table.
Okay. By the way, there's a book in the front. You want to grab?
I'm good.
No, grab a book. It's just sitting there unused. You guys can share it. All right, so here we have a situation where the doctors say Tom is not going to survive without the surgery, without the bypass. He's in very poor shape. He's got heart disease. He's not going to make it. He needs the quadruple bypass. He needs a dramatic change in his lifestyle and getting a healthy lifestyle kicking in. So here's the deal. The doctors tell him, though, that the bypass is not guaranteed to work. It's not even more than likely going to work. They tell him you may die on the table. You might not be able to survive it. He wants to go for it. He wants to take the risk because it gives him a shot at long life. His wife says, you take the shot at long life, you're sacrificing what time you have left. My sister, she says, his wife says in this story, said, died last year on the operating table. She didn't make it out of surgery. So at least you have. However long you have, you have. Why put that in jeopardy? You're going to end up dead tomorrow on the table. He says, look at the positive. I have a shot at life, long-term life. What do you do?
Willing to make the changes in his lifestyle?
Yeah.
Because if he's not willing to stop smoking and drinking, then
he's willing.
Having the operation is
going to work. Yeah, no, he's willing. He's willing to completely...
He didn't say the changes in the lifestyle.
Let's assume he is.
Okay.
What do you have?
I should have read it. His wife wants him out of the way, so you do the surgery and give him the right... Or you don't do the surgery, but have another insurance beneficiary.
I hear you. But these are the tough questions.
You do it.
The tough questions are... when it comes to risky. Lesson 1 was a slam dunk. More than likely going to work. You don't want to do it. But here's not more than likely going to work. It's risky. What do you have?
We're talking about, though, 50-50 on dying or surviving as opposed to
all right, you might have this and it might prolong you a few days, but it's not going to succeed ultimately.
Correct. Correct. If that, we're going to get to that factor a little bit later on in the lesson. What if it's not going to cure, but it's just going to prolong? We're going to get to that. And there are issues to be discussed there. But let's say it's going to cure him. If there's a change in lifestyle, it's going to give him, let's say they tell him, if this works, he's 50. We'll give you another 20 years.
But it's 50-50, he's going to die. It's a 50%
chance on the table.
He's going to die.
Yeah, during the surgery, yeah, he's not going to survive the procedure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, or less than 50. There's not a greater than chance that he's going to survive. In other words, it's 50 or less.
It says that he's going to die in the near future without it.
Correct.
How near is the future?
That's another factor we're going to define. Very good. All of these, what the cure is and what the survival time period without it is becomes a very important issue.
If it's in 6 months.
So let's talk 6 months.
Six months
versus 20 years.
Okay.
But there's a 50-50 shot. What do you do?
Well, can he do it on the 5th month or on the 6th month?
Let's say he's doing it in the 5th. Why does that make, it's a very good point, why does that make a difference? Why in month 5?
Huh? Can, if he does,
because of the, well, I cheated, I read a little bit ahead.
No way, wait a second. I'm going to say that on the contrary. I want to explore your rationale. The rationale was that I have 6 months, so let me ride it out for 5. Not me. Let Tom ride it out for 5, because there's only 1 month left. So what's the big deal then to go ahead? That's not a Jewish approach. This is the first thing I want to point out. Point number one is to say that, well, it's only a month, it's only 2 weeks, it's only a day. Might as well roll the dice because I can gain 20 years is not a valid approach in halacha, that where halacha approaches every moment of life as being infinitely valuable.
Right, but can we look at it on the other hand? If one moment is just as valuable because of, I cheated, the repentance and all that, then you don't want to cheat yourself.
It's out of 20 years.
It's in a bad situation. What I'm saying is,
I'm with you. But it's coming from one perspective. And the perspective is the drive and desire to pursue life. It should not come from a place of, well, we're going to set another case soon where a patient is told they have only 2 days to live. And they need medication right now, but the medication is so toxic it might kill them within a few hours. But if it works, it's going to cure them. But they have 2 days otherwise. So you might say, well, what's 2 days worth anyway? Might as well roll the dice. That's not a valid way to look at it. The valid way to look at it is that even short-term life is life. And yet, if short-term life is valuable, long-term life is also valuable. So if we're rolling the dice, it's not because we're devaluing the short-term life. It's because we're valuing life, and more infinite life is good. Now, once you get into infinite, then the question is, how do you get more infinite? But you'll humor us for this discussion. Yeah.
But I have an argument for the 5 months thing versus doing it when you
yeah.
still have 6 months left. You have 1 month left versus 6 months. His wife wants, like, she's afraid he's going to die on the table.
Right.
So why not have as much time with her as possible? If that does happen and he dies on the table, at least he would have had 5 more months.
I'm with you. Yeah, from that angle, it's fine. But if it's from the other angle of once 1 month is left, then might as well roll the dice anyway. That wouldn't be a right. I know, that's the correct. And that might be what you were saying.
I was saying, I don't understand the one thing that it's not Jewish. I don't understand which one.
To say that short-term life it can be easily discarded for a risky procedure because it's only a short-term life anyway, that's not a Jewish value.
No, I wasn't saying that.
No, I know. You were probably saying more along the lines of what Mindy was saying.
I was saying, because it is so valuable,
let's preserve the 5 months that we have in the bag.
Let's preserve whatever we can preserve
before we need to take the risk.
Because it's,
I'm with you.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But what if they say you have to take the surgery now?
Right,
I mean, then
we get worse over time. But like the girl in the first story, right? She waited. Okay, she thought more about it. Probably got closer to actually realizing she was going to.
Yeah, she was getting worse and worse. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you had a. You know, when it's right upon you, then I think your decisions almost become clearer than when only 6 months or 2 years.
Right.
Away.
Yeah. No, there's definitely. The question, though, is in that case, it was more likely going to work. Here, it's not. It's not. It's not likely that it's going to work. It's not more than likely it's going to work. There's some chance. Are you allowed to do it?
Quick question. From a halakhic point of view, the example you just gave, this is not a Jewish perspective. This is a Jewish approach. Let's say, waited the 5 months,
yeah,
did the surgery in the last month.
Yeah.
Does the rationale make it halakhically valid, or only the action itself? In other words, you do it. If you approach it this way, it's fine. If you approach it that way, even though it wasn't your way, it's not fine. What is it, the action, or is it the rationale?
No. The question is, are you allowed to do it? If halakhically you're allowed to do it, then you could do it from whatever motivation you wanted to do it. If you're allowed to do it, you're allowed to do it.
Oh, really?
The question, yeah. The question we're asking, though, is it halakhically okay? If Tom is asking, Tom is in a dilemma. He wants to do it. His wife says no. So he's going to go to the rabbi, A, for marriage counseling, B, for the halakhic question. What, am I allowed to do it? I want to do it. My wife says, you're not allowed to put your life at risk. How are you risking your life? You're not allowed to do it. Torah says you're not allowed to put your life in risk, and you're risking your life. And Tom says, yeah, but it's at it's for a shot at long-term life.
Yeah, it's almost...
So what does the rabbi say?
From what I've been hearing, the rabbi would say, you can remember the first class or the second we talk about imminent danger.
Yeah.
If it's you know, right now, and that's why I was thinking, wait.
Let's say Tom is imminent danger. Let's say it's imminently dangerous, because he's dying of heart disease. That's imminent. It could happen. They tell him you're a ticking time bomb. At any moment, we can tell you 6 months, but the truth is, tomorrow you can drop dead of a heart attack. They say to Tom. So it's imminent.
So, I mean, it's not 51.
No, it's 50-50 or even less. Let's say it's 30-70. But he says, I want that shot. So what would Torah say? Maybe Torah says, you can't take the shot.
You cannot.
Maybe. I don't know. Let's explore it. Maybe Torah would say, if you're alive in this moment, that you have. To throw everything away... for whatever moments you have for a shot of long term, if it's not likely going to work, maybe you can't do it, or maybe you can. This is what we're exploring. This is the question. In other words, we're balancing short term. These are the two words that I want. I also want to say the terminology. I'll get to your question in a second. There's something called chaye sha'a and chaye olam. Chaye is life. Chaye sha'a means hourly, temporary life, short term life. Whereas chaye olam, olam means forever or larger. So that would mean long term life. So here what we're balancing then is the question of preserving short-term life versus taking a shot at long-term life. Because short-term life he has, whether it's a day, whether it's the next second, he's living right now, but there's an end. He doesn't know when it's going to be, so it's short-term life. Can he risk that? Can he put that on the line, go on the table for a chance, a shot, that's not more than likely going to work at long-term life? That's the question. When life is on the line, no. In other words, here's a question of life and death. It's going to come down to a question of life and death.
The one who's going to be living longer, maybe, is going to have to live with his decisions. Should he do what she wants?
There are certainly other factors. No, I'm with you. I understand the question. There are certainly other factors and important factors and emotional factors and relevant factors to the family and to the kids and to the financial future. There's a lot of factors involved. But the biggest factor, the first one we need to address is, are you allowed to pursue life in this case, or is it irresponsible to life to pursue life in this case? Are you allowed to pursue long-term life, or is it irresponsible to the short-term, whatever you have left, short-term life, to go pursue long-term life? That's really what our question is. In the pursuance of life, in pursuing life, are you allowed to pursue long-term if you're putting your short-term at risk? And a big risk.
Doesn't Torah say that life is above anything?
So which life? You have short-term life and you have a shot at long-term life. That's the question, because they're both life.
I'm having a hard time with the fact that he put himself in this situation to begin with.
Okay. But again, at this point, the question is, which life are we preserving? Short-term life or a shot at long-term life?
Not valued your life along the way, then you don't get to cry boo-hoo quite as loudly when your life catches up. If you drive recklessly, then don't be all sad when you get in a car wreck.
It's not a question of sad or not. I understand what you're saying, but it's not a question.
It could have been an example of an illness or.
No. But even if he did, I'm going to say even if he did cause it, even if it was, if God forbid, let's say he was driving drunk. Let's say he was driving drunk and he smashed. God forbid, he smashed into a pole, and he needs some sort of emergency surgery that could save him, but could kill him, and it's not likely going to work. But he has a few days left. What do you do? Do you say, well, he only has a few days left anyway? Go for it. No, you can't, because short-term life is valuable. Do you preserve what you have? You do take the shot. You roll the dice. He put himself into that situation. I'm giving you a Talmudic eye. He put himself in that situation. That doesn't make a difference. Now we're talking about life. What does Halacha say about life? I understand the perspective of what he did to himself. But at the end of the day, what do you do? Is there an obligation to preserve whatever life you have in the short term? Or an obligation, or permission? There's certainly no obligation to put your life on the line, on the table. But is there permission, if you want, to go for the goal.
Life, but his surgery isn't any different than what he's doing.
Are you saying, let him be reckless? Okay, fine. But if you would have asked the rabbi, am I allowed to smoke and drink heavily? The rabbi would say, no, l'chaim. No, the rabbi would say, no, you can't, because that's putting it. Hopefully, the rabbi would say, no, you can't, because that's a dangerous lifestyle. Am I allowed to drive drunk? No. The question is now, he is coming to a rabbi, or theoretically, we're discussing this from halacha.
You're asking the question, like, quote unquote, cheating. Because...
which I've been known to do before.
Because you're asking, okay, how is it that you are phrasing it? You're phrasing it, are we allowed to life?
Yeah, whatever? Short-term or long-term?
Let's, instead of talk about life, say, are we hasting death?
You could look at it that way. Yeah, that's the question. As a person allowed to potentially, more than likely even, hasten their own death.
Let's. No. So it's a.
So you say no.
If you ask the question the way you're asking it, or I ask it the way I'm asking it,
it's the same thing though.
No.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a different question.
It's the same question. In other words, the flip side of taking my shot at life, the flip side of it paying off is. Tom is setting himself up for a death sentence today, tomorrow, on the table. In other words, he's hastening his own death. That's the question. Am I allowed to take? But I'm not hastening my death because I don't value my life. I'm hastening. Not I. Tom would not be hastening his own death because he doesn't value life. It's because he values life and wants long-term life that he's entertaining a surgery, a procedure, a bypass that might hasten his own death. The question being, so of course you're not obligated to do so. The question is, are you even allowed to? Are you even allowed to put yourself in such a risk? Or might halacha say you're not allowed to move? Well, now to take that step.
What he's doing on the moments that he's alive, if he's so consumed by this whole thing that he cannot have a spiritual life,
that's all right. But that's already quality of life. Let's not get into quality of life. It's about life and death. Let's go to the sources. We need to.
I'm troubled by the odds makers also. You go to a doctor, he says 50-50. Another doctor says 60-40. Another doctor
good.
Says 47.
Let's get into that. So we're going to get into the odds soon. Let's first start off with an assumption of 50-50, and all the doctors, every doctor says 50-50. How likely is that? Not likely. Never happened. But let's discuss that. We have to start somewhere.
I think that I'm obligated, permissible, and forbidden. Definitely not obligated.
Yeah, that we know. You're only obligated if it's 51% or over. If it's less, for sure there's no obligation.
But that percentage is ambiguous anyway. So, but it's definitely not obligated. But I think it can be permissible and forbidden at the same time because it can be... depending on priorities, because that person has to weigh what the priorities for that person, that individual.
Life. Is. Life is number one priority. The question is, there's life in two places, short term and long term. Okay, so let's hit the sources. This is not an easy question. We need to hit the sources. We're starting with text 2a. This is a question that doesn't begin with Tom today needing a bypass. This question was raised, the same exact question in different words, was raised in the 18th century by a rabbi named Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, who wrote a book called Shavus Yaakov. Shavus Yaakov is a book of halachic responsa, basically questions and answers, questions that he was asked, and his answers, his halachic answers, based on his extensive research. He compiled it into a book of his response, called Shvos Yaakov, and here's an excerpt from that. Sisi, will you please read text 2a on page 89?
The question is from an expert doctor regarding a patient who is terminally ill. The prognosis of all the doctors is that he will die within the next couple of days. However, they suggest that there is a medicine that might cure him, but might cause him to die within a couple of hours of taking it. Is it permitted to administer the medicine?
So here, I like this case because you don't have a six-month window. You can't fool around with it. Here you have somebody who is terminally ill. He's dying. God forbid, he's dying. The doctors say he's got a few days to live. They say at the same time there's a medication that is a very powerful medication. It might cure him. It might kill him. Is he allowed to take it? Are the doctors allowed to give it? In other words, does Torah law sign off on the risky treatment? Here's the answer. Here's the beginning of the answer. Continue, please.
Answer. Since this is a question, is a matter of life and death, one needs to consider the question with great care, thoroughly reviewing the relevant passages in the Talmud and Halakhic works. For if someone kills a single person, it is as if he has destroyed an entire world. And conversely, if someone saves a single person, it is as if he has upheld an entire world.
So the beginning of his answer is, we have to take the question seriously because it's a matter of life and death. And matters of life and death need great consideration. The first, right, and this is really the question. The crisis is when life hangs in the balance. You have Chaye Sha'a on the right side, which is the life that, whatever life he has left. Chaye Olam, which is a shot at long-term life. And you have to weigh these two options. Because if you go for the Chaye Olam, if you go for the long shot, for the shot at long life, you might be risking Chaye Sha'a. If not, you're just riding it out, but then it's going to end soon. Okay. So we need to deliberate this. Text 2b, he begins to develop his response. Continue, please, Cece. Text 2b.
It would seem that we should follow the principle. It is preferable to sit and do nothing because of the concern for Chaye Sha'a, even if the ill person is already a gosis in the final throes of life.
What he says is like this. At first glance, one might respond to this question. That one should, here's the quote, Shev v'al ta'ase. This is another halachic term, a term that we find in the Talmud and other halachic sources. Shev v'al ta'ase, which means sit and do nothing. Shev, sit v'al ta'ase. Do not do a thing. What does that mean? It means that we don't take an action in a situation where there are two undesirable choices. When we have two undesirable choices or two unknown choices, or two options. And if we choose one of the options, if we actively choose one of the options, it might bring about a negative result. The best thing to do is don't do a thing because you don't want to be directly involved with doing the wrong action. I'll give you a legal example. Here's a very legal example. Stanley and Ken. Stanley comes to court and is taken, so you're the defendant in this lawsuit. Right. So Stanley is suing you for failure to repay a loan. Because Stanley claims that he loaned you $1,000 6 months ago. And you have not repaid it. Right? Stanley's already thinking, what can I buy with that $1,000 in this theoretical example?
You're already thinking about donations.
Nah, I'm just an example. Now, here's the deal. Here's the tricky thing. Ken, and by the way, there's no paperwork. There's no documentation. There are no witnesses. Ken says, when the court asks him, what do you claim? He says, you know what? I may have borrowed the money. I don't remember. I'm not outright denying that it ever happened. I'm not saying it never happened. He's a liar and furnish proof. It might be true. I may have borrowed the money. I don't remember. How that could be, who knows? This is the situation that Talmud discusses. So the court now is faced with a quandary. Because in general, we say when one person is sure and the other person is uncertain, where does the law lie? With the one who's certain. Because even the one that's unsure is giving some credence to the one who's sure. So you have Shema Ubari Bari Adiv. Someone says Shema maybe, and the other one says I know for sure. You side with the one that's certain. So one might say the court should pull money out of your pocket and put it in your pocket. Why? Because you're sure and you're unsure. And you say maybe he's right. Yet the halacha, the Talmud says, at the end we don't do anything. Why? Because it could be that Ken never borrowed the money. Could be that the loan never happened. And it could be that by giving the money from Ken to Stanley, what's happening is a travesty of justice. And there's a theft happening. And the court doesn't know. And there's no way for the court to know. Because there's no proof. There are no witnesses. How do you know? For the court to take an action in a case where there's any measure of ambiguity is unjust. Rather, the halacha is the sheva al tasa. The court should not do anything. Since if they did anything actively, they might be an accessory to a crime. Let them not do a thing. Therefore, the Shavus Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer says, maybe we can apply the same thing to the case that was presented to me by this physician, where this terminally ill patient is dying in a few days. There's a medication that might cure him. It might kill him. What should we do? Don't do a thing. Why should we take an action that might kill him on the table? Right now, in a few hours, why should we do it? Since we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know. We don't know if it's going to cure him. We don't know if it's going to kill him. So the choice, we're not in a good place with this decision. It's not like, oh, it's definitely going to work or most definitely going to work. Let's go. We don't know. Let's say it's 50-50. It's not good odds either way. What do you do? So he says, it would seem that we should not do a thing. Because why should we, the physicians, or why should even the patient say, let me take an action that's going to kill me, that's going to kill the patient? Why should the hospital, the doctor, or even the patient be culpable in bringing about sudden death? Yeah.
But the fact that you're not making a decision, you are making a decision.
But at least you're not actively doing it. So I understand what you're saying. Inaction is action, but there's a difference in halacha between the action of inaction and the action of action.
The example that you gave with Stanley is like, if you don't do anything, if he really owes the money, he's not gonna pay it.
Right, so it's stealing.
You're causing someone to lose $1,000.
But what you're doing is you're not taking money out of anybody's pockets. The money is when they walked into court, the way they walked in, the way they walked out, their finances are the same. Which means that the court is not actually.
Someone has $1,000.
Moving around, correct. But the court is not moving around the money. The court is not involved. The way they walked in is the way they walked out. Whatever monies they had in their bank accounts before, in their pocket, in their wallets before, is what they're walking out with. So you're right. The fact that they could have taken action and they didn't means that they're signing off on the fact that the money's not owed, but they're not. On one level, yes, bless you, Zugazund. On the other level, Zugazund, they're not actually doing it. They're not doing it. So I understand the concept. The concept is that inaction, silence, is like action. Is like saying that you're signing off on it, but it's not exactly the same. And we find this nuance in halacha where it's preferable. Let's put it this way. Maybe I'll alleviate the question. Let's say inaction is also action. It's preferable to take the action of inaction than the action of action in a case that's unknown. That's what sheval tasa means. That's what it means. If you have two options, inaction, which is action, because you're not. You could be holding back the money that's being owed versus action of actually transferring money in a case that's unknown and will never be known and it could go either way. It's preferable to choose the action of inaction than the action of action. So Rabbi Yaakov Reischer says, if we apply it to the case of the medical risky medical procedure rolling the dice, it would make sense to say, Sheval Tasa, take the action of inaction versus the action of action. In other words, right out the last few days as opposed to taking an action that could kill the patient in the next hour or two. Yeah. Correct.
Because in secular court, there has to be a ruling either way. You can't just sit and do nothing. You have to either rule for the defendant or rule for the court. So,
yeah, I hear you.
So, like, there has to be a decision made.
In football, when we were kids, and something didn't go as planned, there would be a... you like my football analogy? So we used to do something called, and I'm sure you've experienced this before, it's called the do-over. right? It's like nothing happened. But wait a second. So in professional sports, there's no do-over. Although there's a replay of downs. All right, without getting too technical. But there's no like you throw out everything, except for when you do. But I understand what you're saying. In secular court, I don't know. I don't know enough to if there's any case where the court will say, you know, we can't touch it. I think maybe there are cases where the court will say, there's not enough information for us to rule on it.
When you go to court, you have a verdict.
Yeah, burner proof. It's on the one who's extracting.
Then you don't prove your case.
You haven't satisfied it. Now, is the court saying we know it never happened? No. The court's saying that based on the proof that we have, there's no way we can rule to pull out the money, which is really Sheva Altasa. I think it would align with this concept. Okay. Hamas Mechvar Alvaraya, just to tickle Stanley's Talmudic bone, and whoever else knows that, huh? Hamotz mechvar alvarai means that if you want to extract from someone else, if you want to pull from someone else, burden of hamotzi mechavera, one hamotzi lechem. No, hamotzi mechavera, one who wants to draw from his friend, alav haraya. Upon him, upon the extractor, is the raya, is the burden of proof. So in this case, certainly there's no satisfaction of that burden of proof. The courts say no. So, but let's get back to medicine. In this case, Rabbi Reischer says maybe. Since we don't know if it's going to work, let's do nothing. But then he says, on second glance, if you look a little bit deeper, there's actually a Talmudic precedence for this very question that goes the other way. This is a very important text. Text 3a. Randy, will you please read this text? This is a key text to our entire discussion.
Rabbi Yochanan said, if one is so sick that it is doubtful whether he will live or die, and the only physician available is a heathen whose animosity to Jews leads us to suspect that he might deliberately kill the patient, he should not turn to him for treatment. But if, without medical help, the patient will surely die, then he may turn to him for treatment. The Talmud asks, but what of the chayei sha'ah, that is, being put in jeopardy? And the Talmud answers, chayei sha'ah can be disregarded.
The Talmud has a question. The medicine is not risky. The dog, the physician is risky. Here's back in the day, in the Talmudic era, there were Roman doctors trying to kill the Jews. So here you have a nice skull and bones doctor, physician. Again, it's not that the course of treatment is risky. The treater is risky. You don't know. So the Talmud says like this. If it's a question of life, if the patient is not terminal, then don't take the risk. But if the patient is terminal, right? That's there are two cases here. If one is so sick that it is doubtful whether he will live or die, but it's doubtful, it's not for sure that he's going to die, so then you can't take that risk because you can't put yourself in it. But if without medical help the patient will surely die, then he may turn to that doctor for treatment. So again, dangerous doctor, okay? Here you have a patient that's terminal. That will, God forbid, that will definitely, according to all the doctors, will definitely die. How does he know? He went to a Jewish doctor, but the Jewish doctor says, I can't cure you, only that doctor with the skull and crossbones, only he, I'm making up, what is it, skull, what, crossbones, skull and crossbones, okay. Only he can help you. The question is, are you allowed to do it? Rabbi Yochanan says in the Talmud, you're allowed to. The Talmud asks, what about chayei sha'ah? What's the question? Define the question. How? You're devaluing the short-term life. Maybe you should write it out. This is exactly our question, the debate. Do you take a shot for the cure, or do you write out whatever you got? So wait, the Talmud asks, what about chayei sha'ah? How can you go to this doctor? He might cure you, but you might be committing suicide. And the Talmud answers, we can disregard it. Chayei sha'ah can be disregarded. Why? We have an answer. Step by step. The next text is going to be the source of the Talmud, biblical source for this ruling. It goes back to the Torah. Yeah.
Isn't this different? You're comparing the dangerous doctor to the dangerous treatment.
Same idea.
But I don't see it as the same idea because this text said that it was the only doctor available.
Yeah.
I mean, the only physician available.
Yep.
So, but the risky medicine is not the only medicine available.
Let's say it is. Yaakov Reischer's case, the guy is dying in 2 days. The only thing physician said, the only thing that can save him is this powerful drug that might kill him on the spot.
But this doctor thing is different.
It's the same thing. It's risky.
The passage is saying find a better doctor, but if you can, and it's the only one.
Yeah, same thing. Well, I mean, obviously you could find another medication, but you can't. You can't find another doctor, you can't find another medication. Talmud says here you're allowed to go. And I, what about Chaya Shah? You're allowed to disregard it, yeah?
I'm going
to
die someday.
Yeah.
Terminal, right?
Yeah. Good, fine, good question. We have to define what that means. We had the question Tuesday night as well. Somebody said, everyone's going to die, so everyone's terminal. It's not exactly the same thing. It's not. We're talking about short-term, imminently. We're talking about short. What, how do you define short-term? We're going to put a number on it. We're going to put a number on it.
The fact that he's going to this doctor that hates Jews is what makes him like the dog.
Yeah, it's a suicide. It's almost a suicidal act, or potentially a suicidal act. And the Talmud says he's allowed, Rabbi Yochanan says in the Talmud, and this is a halacha, that you're allowed to do it. Why? Because we disregard Chaya Shah. To which the Talmud asks in 3b, continue please.
On what basis do you say one can disregard Chayesha?
Who says that you can just...
So Chayesha is short life.
Yeah, who says you can give up whatever you have for this shot at treatment? Who says you can just give it up for a shot at the long term? And here's the answer. The answer is, there's a story in the book of Kings, Malachim Beis, Kings 2, or 2 Kings, that tells of the story of the four lepers. Anybody familiar with the story of the four lepers? There was the story of four Metzoraim, four lepers. They were living in a place called Samaria. Samaria was the capital of the kingdom of Israel. At that point, the Jewish nation had fragmented, splintered into the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. The 10 tribes and the 2 tribes. The 10 in the north, the 2 in the south of Israel. The capital of the north was Samaria. There was a famine in Samaria. There was a king whose name was Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, who laid siege to Samaria, to the capital. And he had the city surrounded, which made the famine even worse, and people were dying, and there were reports of cannibalism happening inside the city. It was terrible. And then you had four lepers. These were lepers, according to Jewish law, somebody, it's not really a leper, I'm just using that term because it's an English term, somebody with tzarat, which is a biblical skin affliction. It's understood as not to be leprosy, actually. Anyway, so the halacha is they have to live outside, part of their tshuva, they have to be, their path of repentance is that they're outside the camp or outside the city. So they were outside the city, they were standing by, they were by the gates of the city. And they were dying of hunger. Here's their story. Ken, take it away. Text 3C.
There were four men stricken with tzarat at the entrance of the gate. They said to one another, "Why are we sitting here until we die? If we decide to enter the city, we will die there due to the famine in the city. If we stay here, we will also die. So now let us go and let us defect to the Aramean camp. If they spare us, we will live. If they kill us, we will die."
So what's happening? They're facing certain death. They're starving to death. There's no food. There's no food by the gates. There's no food in the city. So they don't have another shot. There's no other shot to get food except for defecting to the Aramean camp, to the camp of Aram.
What's defecting?
Defecting means giving up, surrendering, white flag.
Oh.
But if they defect, they might kill the Jews because they're trying to, they were laying siege to the city. So they might say, "Oh, you're defectors," psh, whatever, off their head. So they're risking their life. But what are they facing? Definite death of starvation. So they're facing not a chance of death, because then you can't take your chance of suicide. They're facing definite death. They're definitely going to die in the short term because they have no food. And there's no other option except for going to the enemy. The enemy might kill them. So what do? They end up, the end of the story is they go there. And what happens? They find that the enemy has abandoned the front. There was a miracle that happened for whatever reason. They had abandoned the front and left all their provisions there. What did these four people do?
Eat.
They sat down and ate. And then what did they do? They sent word inside the city, FYI, the siege is over, the enemy has left, and there's lots of food and provisions right outside. They brought it in. They saved other people, and it was a great miracle that happened. The Talmud says that based on this story, we can derive a law. Now, the question is, how do you derive a law from a story? The idea is that if they had done something wrong, they probably would have been chastised by the local prophet of the time, which was Elisha. And they weren't, and a miracle happened through them. It seems like from on high, there was an acquiescence here. It was signed off as being okay. So again, what do we have? We have people that were facing certain death. These four lepers were facing certain death of starvation. The chance that they had defecting to the enemy was a chance that was fraught with danger. It wasn't more than likely that they would be accepted and given food. And yet they were allowed to take that chance. They were allowed to take that chance. Which means this is the basis for the Talmud statement, the Rabbi Yochanan statement in the Talmud, that one is allowed to disregard short-term life for the hope, for a shot at long-term life, even if it's risky. If one is, and this is the law, is that one is allowed, if one is, God forbid, faced with a certain death in the short term, and we'll define what that means, then one is allowed to take risky steps that might end their life, that might give up even whatever life they do have in order for a shot at long-term life. Okay? That's what we learn from this story right here. Starving in Samaria. There you go.
Are you obligated or you're
back
then? Yeah, for sure. Talmudic era, yeah. Then they forgot about it, and then they came back. Same thing with, you know the joke about it, Israel, that they were digging in it's a great joke. They were digging in Rome, and they found plumbing underground, and they said, oh, look, we have plumbing back in the day. And they dug in another place, in that's Italy. They dug in France, and they found copper, and they said, whatever, they were digging and they found all these things. They said, oh, look what we, and then they dug in Israel, they didn't find anything. They said, look, we had wireless. Back in the day, we even had wireless. Anyway, without getting all the details of the, I think the payoff worked. Yeah.
No, I was wondering if we're obligated.
Not obligated. Permitted. For certainly, no question that you're not obligated to risk your life and to risk throwing away the chayisha, the short term life. But permission, these four lepers seem to have been permitted on high, and there wasn't any negative repercussions. It seems like they were permitted to do what they did. And the Talmud therefore says you are permitted as a physician to administer the medication. If the patient what likes, you're allowed to the toxic medication that might kill him on the spot, but might cure him. And therefore, Reischer in text 4 concludes the same is true. No, the Talmud's case is about, I mixed it up. Talmud's case is not about the medication. It's about, huh? The dangerous doctor, right, right. So these people went to the enemy. Therefore, you're allowed to go to the Kevorkian doctor, huh? The risky doctor, the risky physician, and therefore, text 4, we bring about. We have a case within a case within a case within a case. We have 4 cases here. In case you're keeping track. Kevorkian, Stanley, text 4.
If it is possible that this treatment will completely cure him from his illness, then we certainly disregard Hayah's shah. This is clearly proven by the aforementioned case in the Talmud. In our case, too, since he will certainly die, the physician does not try the medication, we ignore the certainty of a couple of days of life and seize the chance that he will be fully healed. However, the physician should not take this decision lightly. He must weigh the situation carefully in consultation with the other expert physicians in his town, accepting the majority opinion, and procure the agreement of the halakhic authority of the town.
So what he says is like this, that it seems based on biblical and Talmudic precedents that in a case where the patient is certainly dying in the short term and there's a chance that there's something that's going to cure him, he's allowed to take it, take the risk, and risk forfeiting whatever life he does have for the shot at the long-term life, provided A, the physician is not taking the decision lightly, B, he needs to consult with all of the other physicians in his town, and C, there has to be a halakhic authority, an expert on Jewish law in consulted. To make sure that everything has been followed correctly. All right? And now we need, because this is just a little bit too black and white.
And it is not because you don't value
short-term life. Exactly, right? It's because we value long-term life. It's not because we don't value the short-term life. So yeah, you know, he's going to die anyway in 2 days. Might as well roll the dice because maybe he'll be cured. It's not. 2 days is also 2 days. But if he has a shot at long-term life, we could take a shot. Just like the people that were starving to death in the story. Or the guy that's visiting the dangerous physician. But let's define the parameters, because all of these the question of, you know, what are the details? There's a lot of gray area here. They've come up in our discussion. First of all, the first thing we have to define, here we're going to define three things. How long is Chai Yesha'ah? We talked about somebody term someone that's dying and therefore is allowed to risk in order to gain long-term life. Well, what's considered, at what point does it move from short-term life to long-term life? And therefore, you can't risk the long-term life for more long-term life, right? So how long is Chai Yesha'ah? What's the cap on that? How much risk is acceptable? It's risky, right? It was risky to go to the heathen doctor. It was risky to defect to the Aramean camp. Well, how risky was it? Was it 50-50? Was it 20-80? Was it 199? Well, what's the degree of risk that's acceptable? And number three is, what is the definition of success? When the doctors say, yeah, you can have a bypass, and then what? Complete cure? Does it have to be a complete cure in order for you to be allowed to risk? Or an improvement? We're going to define all the three parameters right now. You ready? Buckle up. Definition of Chai Yesha'ah from the sources. Again, the sources are the only things we have. And the two sources are the biblical example and the Talmudic example. Those are the original sources. In those two examples, we had people that were dying. Whether they were dying of starvation at the gate of the city, in the biblical example, or whether this person was dying and needed the dangerous heathen doctor, there was dying happening. So it was a case of terminal illness, terminal something. So there are some that say, Rabbi Cook in text 5a says, that if a patient, God forbid, is diagnosed with a terminal illness, then even if it could stretch on for a long period of time, it's considered Chai Yesha'ah, short-term life, and therefore one is allowed to, permitted, to take risks in order to have that cured.
Can you say that again?
Yeah. Rabbi Cook in text 5a says that the definition of Chai Yesha'ah, which is temporary life, is as long as there is a terminal illness. In other words, like if the patient, God forbid, if a person is told that they are dying of something, specific, not general dying of life, but something specific. Even if it's going to stretch on for a while, for even a few years, or maybe many years, it's grounds enough to seek a risky cure, based on the permission of the Talmud. Some that say, no. You can't pull out. The Talmud was talking about a case where somebody's dying somebody who's dying imminently. The biblical case is somebody dying of starvation. That doesn't take many years to happen. That's imminent terminal death. It's not only terminal, it's imminent. How do you define imminent? So Cook is the only one that says it can go on for several years. Most others say it has to be imminent. How do you define imminent? The best definition we have is 12 months. 12 months is not the next day, but it's short enough within 12 months that we call it imminent terminal situation.
It has to be certain terminal.
Certain. If it's not certain, then it's the Talmud says you cannot consult the heathen doctor. You cannot put your life at risk. Not that you can't have a procedure, you can't have a life-threatening procedure where the odds are not in your favor that it's going to work, where it more than likely, it's or at least 50-50, it's going to kill you on the spot, even for attempting it. Again, the case of the heathen of going to the heathen doctor is, if there's a question of life and death in the patient, you're not allowed to put your life at risk by going to the heathen doctor, the anti-Semite. If the life is definitely a risk, and definitely at risk means there's terminal, and within 12 months, as we're defining it now, then you are permitted to.
What if you can determine for how long you can live with that illness?
You got to consult many doctors.
Because God forbid, I mean, you have illnesses that people tell people you have 6 months to live, and they've been living for 5, 10 years.
You got to take, it would have to be in extensive consultation with the experts of the town or experts in the field. And if the consensus, if you take the average consensus and it's 12 months or more, then it's not considered Chai Yesha'ah anymore, according to most halachic authorities. And therefore, you can't take a risky procedure. If it's less than 12 months, in other words, come back in 6 months. And at that point, it might be considered imminent enough to allow the person to go ahead for it. But 12 months, where did the 12 months come up? From the laws of Trefa. Anybody familiar with the word Treif? What does Treif mean? That's how we call it. What do you have? Yeah. Treif means torn. Explain, what does torn have to do with it? Right, an animal, huh? Yes. Well, yeah, but if an animal is injured, so let's talk about food. So when it comes to food, there's a kosher animal and a not kosher animal. It's not called a treif animal. Treif does not mean not kosher animal. What it means is a kosher animal that is dying and is therefore not kosher because it has a mortal wound or a fatal wound. So here's the deal. If an animal is not going to survive for 12 months, you're not allowed to shecht it and consume it as kosher. It's not kosher. Sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes it's not obvious. And therefore, I'll share with you this. In the kosher process, kosher meat process, you shech the animal. You have to make sure that it starts off as a kosher animal, that there was a kosher slaughtering of the animal. And then afterwards, you inspect the vital organs to make sure that there was no disease or imminent death happening within 12 months. How do you find out? One thing they check, in addition to the heart, are the lungs. So my grandfather on the assembly back in the day, he used to check, but then afterwards he moved to a less exhaustive role, which was checking the lungs. So they actually had a machine that blows up the lungs, and if it maintains the air, then you know they were a healthy set of lungs. If there was a hole or a lesion, you know, there's a flap of skin, anything that might have killed the animal within 12 months, we say it's not kosher, it's a trefa. And then the animal just goes off to the non-kosher part of the plant. For an animal to be kosher, it has to be healthy. What is defined as health? 12 months. Therefore, many halakhic authorities apply this definition of 12 months life as being viable life to what we consider chayisha'a, short-term versus long-term life. If life, according to the consensus of the experts, is less, there's a terminal illness, God forbid, and there's a less than 12 months left on the clock, we consider it to be only chayisha'a, short-term life, and therefore risk is permitted. It's permitted to take risk for a cure. If it's longer than 12 months, doesn't have that same imminent danger criteria. Yeah.
So, as far as eating animals,
yeah,
can you not eat like really old animals?
It depends. The animal has to be a healthy animal. The short answer is it has to be a healthy animal that will have survived, at least with the best guess, for 12 months. A really old animal that's like, you know, like on its throes of death. No, you would not be allowed to shecht it. Correct. For kosher, I mean, whatever else happens to it, happens to it. But not for kosher. Part of the requirement is, it's got to live for more than 12 months. Otherwise, it's called a trefa. Trefa literally means ripped up. If an animal is mortally wounded in the field, you find an animal that was half ripped apart by another animal, you can't shecht it and it's not kosher. It's not kosher. The animal's dying. More subtly, if there's internal damage or even old age, as you said, it's a good example. It's a good point. Even old age, if the assumption is that it's not going to make it more than 3 to 6 months, you can't eat it. Okay, it's not kosher. So that's as far as time frame. That the most accepted time frame is 12 months regarding what's called chaya shah versus chaya olam. How much risk is acceptable? We said so if there's short term life, in other words, if it's less than 12 months and there's a terminal illness involved. So there's permission granted to take a risk. But how much risk? 50-50 risk? 30-70 risk? 10-90 risk? Or 1-99 risk? How much risk is acceptable? Can a person say, you know what? 99% of the time, this is not going to work. But it's my only shot. I want to gamble. Will the rabbi say, go ahead and gamble away 6 months of your life based on a 1% odds of working out? Or will the rabbi say, you can't do it. We just said you're allowed to take risk. But what risk? What's acceptable? So, it's the subject of a dispute. According to Waldenberg in text 6a, John. Stanley, did you read? Stanley, read. John, take it away, 6a.
However, this permission to operate is only if the chance of life and death as a result of the surgery are equal, but not if majority of cases, the patient will die as a result of the operation.
According to Waldenberg, listen to this. Waldenberg says the odds have to be at 50-50 in order to permit the risk-taking. If it's 49-51, then there's no... And if you look at it, then you're not allowed to do it. Why? Because the biblical and Talmudic precedents never gave odds. It never said that it was more than likely that the Arameans would kill the defectors. They only had a small chance. No, it was a 50. They weren't sure. Could have gone either way. They might have accepted us and fed us. They might have killed us. In the four lepers example. Could be 50-50. He says, prove to me that there's any source in the Bible or Talmud that says that you're allowed to risk it if it's less than 50%. This is no, so he's cutting it off at 50-50, which means that 49-51 becomes prohibited. You're not allowed to roll the dice for that. 51 and over, you have to. Listen to what's happening. Within 3 percentage points, you have 3 completely different rulings of halacha. 49% odds of working, can't go there. You have to just write it out, whatever you have left. 50%, you get permission to go to roll the dice at 50-50 odds. 51%, you have to take the surgery. And again, right. So how is it practically going to play out? Because no doctor will give you a definite thing. There's always margin of error, room for it. How it plays out practically is another issue. Theoretically, permission is only granted to 50-50, to 49, according to Waldenberg. One opinion. We're going to have a different dissenting opinion in a second. 6B. If it's less, you're not allowed to, and more, you're obligated. 6B. The dissenting opinion. Continue.
In a situation when we have otherwise given up hope, we disregard Chayasha, even for a remote possibility that the patient will be healed.
Grodzinski says, he goes the opposite extreme. He says, if a patient is facing imminent death and there's no other options, and it's just Chayasha, then you disregard Chayasha, you give up Chayasha, you're allowed to. You don't have to. You can even for a remote possibility. Remote means remote. Remote means... low percentage points. In other words,
Hail Mary.
You're allowed to. You don't have to, obviously, but you're allowed to. According to Waldenberg, you're not allowed to unless it's 50-50, unless you have an unequal shot of making it. He says, no, even a remote chance, even if it's 5%, 1% maybe, remote chance, you're allowed, if you want, you're allowed to. If you're facing, God forbid, if a person is facing, God forbid, a terminal, imminent terminal death, terminal illness, imminent death, then they're allowed to take it. Others find the middle ground and say not remote but reasonable. And what's reasonable? 20-30%. So here's the deal. If you want to take the middle ground, and many do today take the middle ground, a rabbi might say, if the doctors are coming in, if the procedure is coming in at 20-30% odds of success, that's risky, but as long as there's a 20-30%, a person may risk it, if they have only less than 12 months to live. If it's under 20% and there's only a remote chance, Grodzinski says it's fine, but most say, today, at least the middle ones.
What did he get this time?
The remote? Yeah. Because he said on the other extreme, the Talmud doesn't say that it was only allowed because there was an equal chance. The Talmud is vague. The Talmud doesn't, and the biblical story is vague. It's, you know, they wanted to surrender to the Aramean army, the Aramean forces. What were the odds? So Waldenberg says they have to be 50-50. He says, no, maybe there's a remote chance. What about the heathen doctor? Heathen doctor. What are the odds that the heathen doctor is going to kill the Jewish patient? The Talmud didn't specify. So you either play it safe, 50-50, or you say, you know what? Maybe it was very likely that he would kill the Jew.
There's no way to find out. You can see how many people got actually killed by the doctors at the time.
Yeah, but there's no statistical. But there's no statistical data. I'm saying these are. We're talking about halachas. No, you're right. But there are halachas that are looking at it today. There's no historical data. I mean, if there was, they would look at it. There's no historical data preserved from that time. To what were the odds that an anti-Semitic doctor back then would kill a Jewish patient?
So what do you do? You shop around rabbis.
No, you find... No, hopefully the rabbi is going to be... There's strong shoulders to rely on either way. So hopefully the rabbi will have... Every situation will be judged on its own merit. And based on the individuals involved, and the circumstances involved, and the procedures involved, and the other factors, the family, the wife's opinion maybe, you know, and the kids. And at that point, you hope, siyata d'shmaya, with God's help, that the right psak, the right ruling comes down. But again, there's a gray area, and there's variations in what the halachas say. Bottom line is there's very broad, strong shoulders to rely on either extreme. Even though they go from one extreme to the other. But they're all theoretically consistent with Torah precedent, with halachic precedents. As long as it's not inconsistent, you're not following halacha. Should you shop around? No. You should find somebody that you trust, and hopefully they're making the right decision. They're going to pass down the right decision. Yeah.
So what about if you're 2 years out, but having the treatment now, will you have better odds? Not necessarily 50.
Is it going to kill you? That's the question. Are you allowed to go? Are you allowed to try something that's going to work? Yeah. Is it going to kill you?
Right.
on the table. If it's 50-50 going to cure the table, and there's only and there's 24 months, only Cook would say you're allowed to. No one else would say you're allowed to, because 50-50 chance that you're going to kill yourself. God forbid, you're setting yourself up for death right now. If it's not a death, if it's a shot at a cure, yeah, why not go for it?
But I would just say that if it increases the odds that you're going to die on the table by waiting longer.
So now it's even fuzzier odds, because now it's, you know, 25% chance of working, 30% chance of not working, and another 50% chance of just helping. See, now it's a further gray area, right?
Well, I'm just trying to say, if you wait, like you're out, and I'm taking outside of that 1 year, but it's you have more, you're less likely to die on the table having it 2 years out than waiting until you get within that 1 year.
Okay, so you're saying that the odds are better if you do it now.
Right.
But what are the odds?
Right. Well, they're not quite 50. They're not quite 50.
It's right. They're not. It's not more than, yeah.
But the longer you wait, the weaker you get. The more likely.
That could be. I hear your question. It could be that a Rav would take that into consideration in making this determination, since there are those that say, like Cook, that if it's terminal, even if it's longer than 12 months, you can risk the short-term life to pursue a cure. It might be in that situation where the odds are only going to get worse as that 24-month window gets closer. We need to push up the time. And there are those that say anyway that it's fine to roll the dice. That would be a very good example of where the fifth part of Shulchan Aruch would come in. There's four parts of Jewish law. The fifth part is common sense, intuition, common sense, and feeling it out. That might be a situation that calls upon that fifth thing. We're gonna close right now. One thing I want to mention. Oh, first of all, how do you define successful treatment? You can read about that in Tech 7. Okay, one more thing, though, that we need to mention. Experimental treatments. That's not risky. Risky and experimental are two different animals. Risky means we know bypass works. We don't know if this person is going to survive the surgery on the table. Experimental means we don't even know that this works. You can read about the case. I believe it's on Tech. I mean, don't read it now. Learn case study 2 on page 100. Read about it. You know, you have a week to read it. It's a baby Z. She's dying of a rare brain illness. The only thing that there may be something, might be something that works, never been tried on humans. Are you allowed, as parents, or even as a patient, are you allowed not to take risks, but to go experimental? Experimental is different than risky. Again, there's no way to measure the risks. We talked about percentages. It's never been tried on a human. What are the odds? It's unknown. Experimental also means that there's no. It's very different than the case of the biblical case of food. We know that food cures hunger. We know that a doctor, even though there might be a heathen anti-Semitic doctor, we know that theoretically the doctor may cure this thing. But the experimental treatment, we don't even know if it'll cure it at all, and it might be toxic, it might be deadly. So there are some that say you can't touch experimental treatment. Even if life is on the line, even if this baby, God forbid, is dying in the next week because of a rare brain illness at birth, huh? So even if the baby is dying, God forbid, of this rare brain disease, brain illness, there are some that say you cannot take the risk, the experimental treatment, because it's putting the life on the line, and you can't sacrifice the short term life. However, there are those that say, based on those that extend, as we just read from Grudzinski, those that extend the risky to include even remote shots at a cure, there's some that say the experimental would be okay. So again, it's every case would have to be judged on its own merit, and it might depend on who you ask, but you got to find somebody that you're comfortable with. That's experimental, and that's pretty much today's lesson. One final point, as we conclude, and that is that if somebody, God forbid, is dying, a loved one, family, a friend, a family member, a friend, Torah law mandates that we be there for them. I just want to mention this point. It's sometimes hard to watch somebody that we love suffer. It's terrible. But there's a mitzvah, because every moment of life is precious. The last moment's no less precious than the first moments of life. And even if it's tough, and even if it's exhausting, there's an obligation to be there for our loved ones in the last moments, to be there for them in whatever life they have left. That they live with dignity, that they're surrounded by loved ones with strength and with whatever it means. It doesn't mean unrealistic expectations. It means not in any way bringing negative messages.
Not abandon ship.
Don't abandon ship. And you know there's a law against bringing the spirits down of somebody who's dying, because it might hasten their death. You're not allowed to come in a bad mood. You have, and a cheery mood doesn't mean, oh, you're going to be healthy today. But it means supportive. It means supportive and loving. But to be all negative and depressed around someone who's dying, you're not allowed to. And even to encourage closure and the vidui, the confession that's supposed to be recited at the end of life should be done in a manner where you tell the loved one, I think it's time to recite the confession. But know that not everyone who recites it dies. There are many that have recited it and have recovered and lived. So it doesn't mean it's a death. But look at that sensitivity. You encourage someone to find closure. At the same time, don't think that just because you're pursuing closure, it has to be the end. Could be it's not the end. But now's the time to find closure. It's the same thing as Yom Kippur, the same achet. It's the same confession that we do on Yom Kippur. And if the person is too weak to do it, then it's done typically by a loved one or a rabbi. Or say the Shema. The Shema is also. But you say the Shema, but you can't. You don't want to turn off hope for the person. You're not a day, not hasten death. Then you reset it for them. But there's such a beautiful respect and sensitivity to life within Jewish law and philosophy. And I hope that's coming through in this course. Thank you for joining me for lesson 3 next week. We talk about new beginnings, the ethics of reproductive technologies. What does Jewish law say about artificial insemination, about embryonic stem cell research? These issues, these beginning of life issues, are going to be discussed. Stem cell research! Hot button topic next week. Artificial insemination. What are the ethics of reproductive technologies? How open is Judaism to making use of new reproductive technologies and those who are struggling with infertility? This is next week's topic. I look forward to seeing you. Same bat time, same bat